Have you guys seen that Eddie Murphy film from the 1980s, the one where he's a prince that comes over to the U.S.?
Like when he's in New York?
Yeah, I think it was New York. I think Samuel L. Jackson was also in it, too.
Oh, you mean like Coming to America?
Exactly. Well, that kind of speaks to this whole episode. This was Coming to America.
Hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast, episode 7, Prayer for Mad Sweeney. We are your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Andrew Sarcini.
And Tosin Unifawakin.
We just watched the 7th episode of Starz American Gods titled Prayer for Mad Sweeney. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers to come. But before that, let's dive into the after talk, and we'll catch you up on how to reach us first. Here's our online links. You can follow us at Twitter at Gods Podcast, or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. You can write or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. Add us on iTunes. And if you do so, please like us and leave us a review. That's how we get some notice for our show. Before we get into what we thought of the show, Dwayne, why don't you give us a brief recap of what we saw this episode?
Super brief recap. All right. The entire episode, as Tosin said, was a Coming to America scene. We meet an Irish woman named Essie Tregowan and follow her fate across, you know, time and overseas. Mad Sweeney kind of obeys Laura and allows them to release Salim from their care. So the Three Stooges have been broken up. The two, you know, Mad Sweeney and Laura, they go in search of Shadow on Wednesday. A rabbit, because all rabbits are evil, disgusting, and terrible, ask Anya from Buffy and ask me, actually causes Laura to swerve and wreck the bus they're driving, the truck they're driving. And after that happens, Sweeney makes the choice to reanimate Laura with the coin, since her kind of guts open up and it spills out. And he didn't have to do that. So that's interesting. And even though that happens, and Sweeney takes kind of pity on her and reanimates her, Laura doesn't seem to know what happened, which begs the question about her afterlife situation. And at the end of it, they keep on moving on after we learn about sort of the fate of Essie Tregowan. So that's the gist of what happened during the episode. It was beautifully shot and edited. I feel like I was watching a movie more than a TV show for most of it. And I think a big thing here is us understanding the nature of you know, kind of how gods are made and kind of the nature of Laura. We're still trying to explore that and explain that.
Thanks, Dwayne, for that brief recap. Let's move into the salient visual and stylistic thematic points about the episode. What stood out to you, Dwayne?
One of the big things that stood out to me was at the beginning of Coming to America, we get this space where Mr. Ibis writes,
"Yeah,
it's a fine fiction that America was settled by pilgrims seeking freedom to believe as they wished, that they came to the Americas, spread and bred, and filled the empty land. In truth, the American colonies were as much a dumping ground as an escape, a forgetting place." And then he goes into transportation, which is a big piece of what's happened in America, like how people got here. We always think about Australia, the myth that it's a penal colony. It's
right.
A whole bunch of prisoners who spread and bred. America, North America, the British colonies were not too different. There was a history here, and that history was if you were in Britain and you were bad, they used to kill you. But when the colonies showed up, in order to make their colonies work better economically, they needed more people. It was hard to establish colonies. It was hard to keep people there. It was harder life for a lot of it. So what they did was they would send criminals out there, and they basically would be like, you have to think about what you did and for like 7 years, and you'll think about it as you work on a farm or produce for the king or, you know, break rocks or mine gold or whatever it is that whoever bought your contract decided you would do. So it was all a commodity. You got on, like you were sent to maybe die, and you got away from dying. And let's say it was 5 years, right? So you had to go on a boat, and the captain buys your contract. A 5-year contract on a boat takes you 3 months to get over the ocean. and then he sells your contract 4 years and, you know, however many months he wants. Mm-hmm. He probably lied and pushed it later, right? Instead of like just doing 4 years and 7 months, he'd be like, no, it's 5 years. And you had no say in the matter. And somebody would buy that contract and you'd work alongside, you know, you probably work alongside slaves in the beginning, right? You'd be there picking cotton or tobacco or whatever, or panning for gold in the Indies, working the sugar fields. They needed bodies to fuel the capitalism that was growing these empires. And this is a story about how a woman experienced that, and basically cheated death twice. The first time being so young and so extractive, they sent her in transportation. The second time, using her feminine wiles, as the old phrase was, and allowing herself to plead her belly in order to get a job as a wet nurse in the colonies and getting around. And I thought that this idea, this truth takes away from this kind of idea that America was a whole bunch of honest-to-goodness pilgrims in society running things. It was people being people, you know, unplanned pregnancies and love and, you know, bad decisions and all the same stuff that we see today that so many people would love to decry and say is unwholesome. It's always been that way, and that's kind of cool.
Tosin, what do you think this episode is called, Prayer for Mad Sweeney?
Well, throughout the course of this episode, we kind of get a vision of how Mad Sweeney came to be, how he gained his power as a god for people, especially, you know, the main individual, Essie, leaving sort of bits and pieces, gold, as well as potentially his original coin, as well as bread and other sorts of foods and trinkets, leaving sort of sacrifices maybe for Mad Sweeney. So she's essentially praying for the luck and the luck of the leprechauns, and that's how he was born. Something else that you kind of note is that, you know, for Mad Sweeney himself, he also does kind of need the prayer to sustain himself. We get a glimpse of that when he's in the prison and having that conversation and sort of, you know, how he almost died on the battlefield and kind of knew that he had to sort of change things and knew that things had to take a different turn. So I think this is kind of a large part of that episode that you see pointed out over and over again.
Did Mad Sweeney die in that prison? Is that what we're meant to believe?
It's hard to tell because on one hand, it seemed like maybe he sort of escaped, but I wasn't quite clear. What did you guys think?
Yeah. Andy, what did you think?
I mean, I think that possibly he did, but we know that if he's as a god, that he is revived when someone brings him to the to the new world. I also want to offer regarding the title. This might be a small thing, but I think it's worth mentioning that it could be also a play on. There was a John Irving novel published in 1989 called A Prayer for Owen Meany, which this could be a little bit of a tip of the hat to that.
Oh yeah, that's very true. And for those of you who have kind of read the book, the title, you know, makes you think one thing. It might happen in the sequence of events, without me like spoiling it. And that doesn't occur in this entire episode. So
yeah.
Play on words there too.
We thought we were going to see something happen in this episode, and it's yet to happen in the show. So what did you guys think about the different format of this episode, like how they laid things out?
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, I got to say, it was a little difficult that we lacked a certain forward plot motion.
Yeah,
that we're used to when we binge watch things. But at the same time, we spent time building character in a very meaningful way. We still don't. I mean, we just learned what Wednesday is, right? And in the beginning, the very, very, very first episode, we get this layout of perhaps how Wednesday got here, how the ancestors of Eric the Red landed on these shores in America.
Right.
They weren't able to establish themselves, but they tried really hard, and they brought their god. And so perhaps Wednesday was waiting when they were already here and waiting when Eric the Red showed up. This kind of lays out how a more mundane approach, right? People come here and they share their stories, and something builds until you get this apotheosis or whatever, where the incarnation of a being supernatural like Mad Sweeney shows up. A guy who calls himself, who says he was a king once, who has the memories of what people felt in the old country, but was never actually there. And so there's a solemnity, a loneliness to people like Sweeney. Yeah. And it's pretty interesting.
You know, one thing that this episode definitely did, I feel like that we don't get a lot of in the other episodes, is that, you know, we're to understand in the other episodes that Ibis is writing these Coming to America stories, and it really wasn't sort of overtly stated in previous episodes, but in this episode we really do nail down that concept that Ibis is sort of like the narrator for almost this whole tale that we're seeing.
There's a phrase in African cultures, African diasporic cultures, right? And that phrase is the keeper of the word.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It seems very much like that's what Ibis is. So much so that Mr. Jackal's like, you have a tale to tell. I can see it
right
in your hands.
Right.
Not in your eyes, but in your hands. Ibis then realizes this compulsion is upon him and sits down to record it. How he gets the data, how he gets the information remains a mystery to us, which I like. But the fact is the compulsion is to put it down. And it's like only once it's down does it exist. You know, it's like it's constantly being fed to him through some supernatural network. And he has to add it to this great book. And one has to wonder what happens when the book is full. Is it a new book or is that kind of a Ragnarok situation?
Right. You know, like, what's the purpose of even documenting this, right? What does it fulfill?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah. No, I really enjoyed at least the explanation of who is, you know, telling these tales and kind of how it came to be. However, throughout the course of the episode, at least for the first, let's say, 15 minutes or so, I was, you know, I kept thinking, okay, when are we going to get back to the main storyline? When will this end?
Shadow on Wednesday, yeah.
You know, how long is this portion? And it took me a while to recognize that it was going to be throughout the episode.
Right.
And then you had some forward-facing depictions. So that was a little, it was a little strange because it was unexpected that we were going to go from the past to the present so often.
Yeah, nice intercutting, though. I really like that. I really like basically when we get to sort of telling two different stories linearly and concurrently in the show. And I think when we get into, we'll talk a little bit more about casting notes when we get a little bit later on in the show, but there's definitely some stuff I want to talk about when we get to that point.
Yeah, saliently, speaking of casting, you know, S.C. Tregowan, played by Emily Browning, the makeup, right?
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was incredible. Like, yes, the wig is a wig. Who cares, right? But they did something there where they basically managed to cover her face in visually realistic freckles. And as a guy who's always trying to think about hiding his own freckles, this is a thing. As a guy who just spent a weekend with his super bespeckled cousin who just got married, this is something we think about all the time in my family, like freckles and like all that stuff. And they managed to just put them on her. Like that's not easy because they have to be like dotted or sprayed,
sure,
or something.
Sure.
I mean, you typically don't think about makeup unless you're looking at someone like media, you know, when Gillian Anderson is playing David Bowie or playing, you know, Marilyn Monroe or whatever. But this was a case of makeup that I thought was really also mind-blowing. They're doing incredible things with taking different actors and showing them off as various people. And I thought that was pretty interesting. I mean, I look at Pablo Schreiber's Leprechaun, and I'm like, well, some of his beard still looks brown. You know what I mean?
Right.
But when I look at what they did with Trigon, at first I had to do a double take. Is that Emily Browning? She looks just like Emily Browning. And then voila, I realized it was her, and I was like, wow, that was impressive. That wasn't easy, you know?
Yeah. Props to the makeup people on the show for everything they're doing, hair and makeup and costume in this whole show too. Just that sort of verisimilitude of putting us in, that era,
and throwing us into multiple periods and then bringing us back to the present and making it all feel real. Right. That's what's so cool. Like, cause we're going 16, whatever, 1645, 1721, 17, whatever. Even long before that with, Nunu Winnie from a couple episodes ago, or
right.
even before that with, what was going on with, the Scandinavians from Iceland. Those are all period pieces tied into a contemporary piece. Those are big challenges.
Yeah. And bringing all that, you know, and folding it all in and having it all work well, it's a challenge. So, like, big props to them. Let's talk about the big white buffalo, which in many ways the symbol of the show. You know, it's a big piece in the novel as well. But in the show, we see it in
for the first time,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty straightforward. They walk out. There's this huge white buffalo. If you went to South by Southwest, they actually had a magnificently large buffalo statue covered in hair, not just like a piece of stone.
Mm-hmm.
That was there, surrounded by the bones from the bone orchard. And you were like, oh. And it had like smoke coming out of its eyes or whatever. It was crazy. It was. But even that big statue that was feet and feet taller than me was smaller than the depiction that was on screen. Now that could have been CGI or whatever, but this kind of ties back to the idea that there are these places of power in America.
Right.
That was interesting. But I think Matt Sweeney had a quote on that one. Tosin, what was that quote?
The quote was, "What you get for putting a god in a petting zoo."
Right, because basically it died like a year to the day it was born or something. And it wasn't treated like a god, like the way Sweeney is a god, or a supernatural at least. So that was pretty interesting. Last week we talked about how Laura had no shame, but when Laura realizes that she's kind of like splayed open, she suddenly becomes shy, and she's like, "Sweeney, don't look." What did you guys think of that kind of reversal of the role she laid out for herself?
Well, it seems like she always has this sort of external persona and an external face that she shows, but it seems like she just doesn't want others to really know what's truly on the inside and see her innards. Oh, that's kind of how I took it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's deeper than I was going.
I didn't even think about that. I definitely get the sense for Laura that there's a difference between being naked after death and in being there's a modesty, to an extra level of modesty for her to being exposed, having her opening exposed, having the insides exposed, because it's a betrayal of who she actually is, which is a walking corpse. So it hits a little too close to home. It's too real, and I think that's what is sort of why she feels modest about that, because she doesn't like to have that truth exposed. That's what I got out of that bit.
That's interesting. Yeah, I also feel as if it's about like, you know, she's reminded that she's actually dead. And we get reminded about that the whole entire time. There's more and more flies buzzing around her.
Yeah.
And when she's laying on the ground, her eyes are, you know, languid, like this kind of like white color and all that other stuff like that. But what really gets me is that she was kind of, as a person who had no shame, yeah, like anal sex, whatever, she's there now, and she realizes that like part of her power was her beauty, and that is also gone away, right? She's there, and you know, if you cared about the way her breasts look, they're not attached to her body anymore. They're just flaps of skin tied to other flaps of skin that are not, you know, like this sewn portion down her center is open. And so there's nothing attached. She even says so when he offers her, you know, ice cream. She's like, well, since my stomach's sewn up, it's not going to talk to anything else. So what's the point? It's just going to like languish in there and like become like fodder for like worms and shit. So she doesn't get into that. She doesn't eat the sweet. So she's dying, and it's taking away from her identity. And that's really interesting.
Right. Yeah. You guys have any favorite quotes from this episode?
Yeah, I think tied to that whole thing, you know, Laura used to see herself, or is used to seeing herself as like a beauty, which, you know, Emily Browning is, and you can see how the character of Laura is tied to that. And so there's this one quote. It says, "Malice draped in pretty can get away with murder." And I think that's super interesting, because I think that's a piece of what we dig in cinema. In movies, this idea that like there's a femme fatale, and quite literally, she's a femme fatal, right?
Yeah,
that's the thing. Meanwhile, you've got Media, played by Gillian Anderson, who's a femme fatale, whether she's Lucy or Marilyn Monroe or whatever. It's kind of like not quite the help me, but definitely like honeypot sex appeal is how I'm trying to drive you to follow my influence. And Laura kind of played the same game, right? She used to play this, you know, shadow my sex appeals. What's going to draw you to influence me? Robbie, same thing, for me to influence you. So that was pretty interesting to me.
There is a little bit of an aspect of a noir to this tale, to American Gods in general.
Yeah. Well, definitely. And I think the S.C. Tregowan's tale is a tale of a femme fatale. In all honesty, right? Like S.E. Tregowan, she used the captain to get back to England, and then she used the jailer to get back from to the U.S. from dying, and then or the colonies, and then she the guy whom she was wet nursing the baby of, with her child that was born of the jailer. Advanced on her, she did this femme fatale thing in order to get him to marry her. So she gets what she wants through the femme fatale persona. But I think that the noir thing is, you know, there's a mystery here. And whether it's Shadow trying to figure it out or Laura trying to figure it out, there's a lot to try to understand. And that mystery brings on the noir vibe.
Tosin, how about yourself? What any notable quotes that you had from this episode?
There was another quote that was pretty profound, where they said, "Unfortunately, the more abundant the blessing, the more we forget to pray." And this came at the point where EC had been, you know, doing a lot of sort of robbing and living in luxury, and had stopped leaving the sacrifice. Had stopped leaving the sacrifice off for Mad Sweeney.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's kind of interesting about it is that, you know, this is opposite of what Salim had said last episode, where he said, "I pray to God to thank him."
Right.
And he also actually said something fairly interesting about praying to God this episode when he was questioned by Laura. Do you guys remember what that was?
Yeah, he said, he basically was like, she's like, "Are you in love with your God?" And he's like, I definitely love him. He went short of saying, "I'm in love with him." But he's a five times a day prayer, right?
Right.
That's a pretty big deal when it comes to religiosity in the U.S., especially now. So that was interesting. But he's like, "Yeah, I suppose I do love him." And I think for me, that reminded me that Laura, she doesn't quite pray to Shadow. Mm-hmm. But Shadow is her God, and she is in love with him. And that was interesting to me.
Yeah.
but it threw me off definitely when she asked him that question. I also thought it was cool, like what you said, Salim. Salim had said before, I pray to God to thank him. Whereas, you know, in the U.S., oftentimes you hear priests and preachers say, you know, pray and beg God for this and beg God for that. The idea of praying to get stuff never entered Salim's mind, and that's kind of huge because other cultures do that all the time.
So that's the salient points to this episode. Let's move on to the big picture, guys. That's where we, it's a section where we discuss how the events in this particular episode impact what we know about the overarching story arc. Dwayne, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, we don't see Wednesday or Shadow in this episode at all. It's a complete focus on these three Stooges and how they break up and what they do next. But yeah, we don't see them. I mean, do we see them anywhere, Wednesday and...
Well, unless you count the conversation with the Ravens that Matt Sweeney was having, where he essentially told them to fuck off, and yeah,
that was pretty interesting.
And I guess there was a little bit of alluding to Wednesday when we sort of discover that he or someone had some sort of influence in the crash that seemed death of Laura, yeah. That it also appears that Matt Sweeney was involved in.
Yeah, and it's almost like he owed it to Odin to get in there. There's also the moment where, you know, they're driving and you can see the light that is Shadow from mm-hmm. Laura's eyes and her perspective. So Shadow exists in her future. She's looking forward to seeing him. She's chasing him. So I guess he shows up in that way. But we don't see, you know, Ricky Whittle, the actor playing Shadow, or Ian McShane, the actor playing Wednesday at all. And that's pretty interesting for a show that's very much about them. When you think about it, it's traditional understanding. So that was pretty cool. So one question I have is, you know, Emily Browning, as you said before, is playing Essie Tregowan. Does this mean that Laura, and, you know, obviously Mad Sweeney likes her because she's been putting out stuff for him and everything.
Yeah.
And then he does a thing in the end where he, like, puts the coin back in her body.
Right.
Is Laura the descendant of Essie Tregowan? Does Mad Sweeney remember that kind of family fealty or loyalty? Is that why he puts that back in there? Like, what are we seeing when we see Emily Browning playing Essie Tregowan? I mean, Andy, I think you have some ideas about this.
Yeah, I don't think I honestly believe that this is a basically a device on the show for two reasons. I mean, first of all, a good section of this episode, or over half of this episode, is about a new character whom we've never met, and I think logistically, from a production side of things, if you're going to introduce a new character and have them dominate most of the show, it would be disorienting for the audience to cast this actor or this actress whom no one has ever seen and have them lead the show. And I think it's just more elegant and convenient to give that role to Emily Browning. You know, she's capable. I think she's Australian, so she can she can do a decent. Although I have to say, to her detriment, I felt that Essie McGowan's accent was not quite. Emily Browning missed the mark a little bit
every once in a while you heard that her accent was not exactly as genuine as it could have been.
I
agree with that.
But props to her for trying, at least. Yeah. And I think
it's kind of like, it wouldn't have worked if she weren't Irish, and the only way to believe she's Irish is if she had some accent. Because Irish people are the people who brought the leprechauns here in this story.
Right.
So she needs to be Irish. But I do agree. I almost think as if there was some way of saying, I don't know, she was born in Cornwall or whatever, and her accent was different because of that, that would have worked, you know? Just like, give it an excuse. Give a not perfect accent an excuse, and that always helps.
Right, right. Well, and also I think in this case, since we're intercutting between Mad Sweeney and Essie, and Mad Sweeney and Laura, it just makes sense to give.
Because Mad Sweeney's accent is very, very Irish.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to just give that role to Emily Browning so that they can be the two of them, you know, cross-cutting between eras. So just simpler that way.
Emily Browning gets around in this show. I mean, like,
yeah,
her characters are like hooking up with Shadow, hooking up with the jailer, hooking up with the sea captain, hooking up with the plantation owner. Like,
this is,
she's loved.
This is definitely a career making role for Emily Browning, who's been great in other things that she's been in before, but I think this is a real sort of showcase piece for her.
Vehicle, yeah.
So one thing that stood out to me during this episode was when Essie said, in the Americas, anyone can be anything they insist upon. New name, new life, that's a place a body could be happy. What do you guys think about this quote?
Yeah, I mean, I think I like this quote. I like this idea. I think this is a conceit that we as Americans have taken as part and parcel of what we call the American dream, the idea that you can you create your own fortune. You know, you are free to invent yourself, particularly as I think a good portion of this show addresses the immigrant experience. I mean, it's a huge part of what this show is about. It's about the immigrant experience, I think, more than anything else. So, and as such, it's one of those American dream conceits of being an American, is that you come over and you are able to create yourself in whatever image you like on your own merits. So I do like that.
When you say conceit, you mean it's like a
fanciful notion.
Okay, yeah. It's not quite the reality, but it's something that is driving us anyway, despite right. not being the reality.
If it's true or not, it's something that we like to believe is true.
Yeah, so another question I've got is, why did Sweeney revive Laura? What are your thoughts around that? You know, it doesn't appear that she gave him the coin freely, but it does seem that he's able to walk away. Or at least physically walk away.
Yeah.
If you know, he's like, he could have just taken it and gone. But, and this is why I wonder if Emily Browning reminds him of Essie Tregowan, who did all that stuff to make him whole, right? Or if this is just a question of him being a sweet person. I don't know. It's very confusing to understand why he who was being beat up by Laura and really wants his coin back is like, I'm gonna put the coin back into her and be all right. You know, he who said, I'm gonna pick it up from your ribs one day, gets it having fallen from her ribs and says, I'm gonna put it back, no worries.
Well, he does all this sort of you know, cursing in Gaelic and gesticulating. And I think what it is basically his conscience. He's got a crisis of conscience where he realizes that he could be a, you know, selfish a dick and just take the coin and go, as that's sort of the reason that he's been journeying with Laura all this time. But I feel like he does have that crisis of conscience, and he realizes he needs to follow through and let Laura become resurrected again. So right.
You begin to believe the resurrection. That is to say, you begin to believe that that's what he's actually interested in, as right. opposed to just, you know, having a transactional view of the relationship.
Well, it could also be, you know, it could be this thing as like, I killed you once, and you know, I feel bad for killing you twice.
Oh, that's huge, yeah.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
They lay out, in fact, that he is in some ways responsible for the Robbie Laura death. However that's possible, I don't know, considering the events we think we know. But
I mean, I think
he was on site, let's just say it that way.
Yeah. I think that's the what we're to infer from what we saw. And Mad Sweeney's communication with the ravens or the crows, which are, I guess, standing in for Wednesday, that, you know, Wednesday made this deal with Mad Sweeney ages ago to get in the way and have Laura's the car that she's in go swerving off the road and essentially kill her in order to guide Shadow Moon's fate from that far back. So I think you're right. I think you definitely have something there. This is a conscience, basically out of guilt.
Yeah, and then he gets punched in the face. So yeah, right. Feeling great about that one.
I think he's used to it by now from Laura, right?
Yeah, I mean he's like, you ingrate, but whatever. He's the opposite of Trigawin, who was like, I'm going to give you the crumbs if I have a slice of bread, and I'm going to give you a whole loaf if I have a field of wheat. You know,
we get a nice little quote at the very end of this episode when Ibis is telling the story of Essie Tregowan and about her continuing to tell the fables of the leprechauns and what you're supposed to do to keep them alive. He says, she told them all these things and they believed because she believed.
It's the crux of the episode and of the entire series. This idea that the very essence of establishing a paradigm, a dominant paradigm, is to say the reason why we do these things is because they give us whatever benefit. And when she's telling the stories about how these pixies or fairies or whatever can come get you if you don't pull out you've got to pull out your crumbs or your bread or your salt or whatever, put the salt in the bread in the pockets, that kind of thing. This is all about a way of seeing the world, what we call secondary theory, how the world actually works as opposed to what we all see in the world. And this is the essence of the dominant paradigm. Our current dominant paradigm has things like gravity and electricity, electromagnetism and control. Hers, the control came from a guy like Mad Sweeney. If you take care of the pixies, they'll take care of you too. If you take care of the leprechaun, they'll take care of you too. And that's an interesting paradigm, one that we don't share now, but one that people used from time immemorial, because they had to believe there was something bigger than themselves, and that's what she had chosen to believe in, despite the fact that, like, statistically speaking, she would have been Christian, she would have had, you know, all the trappings of that. The time she spent focused was focused on the idea of, let me just make sure that my child, my grandchild, my whatever, yeah, survives well. And that was kind of cool.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. It's about a girl that I once knew.
All right, we're going to take a short break here, and when we return, we're going to talk more spoilers as we look at what's different between the book and this week's episode. So take a listen to this and come on back. All right, so let's take a look at some of the significant changes between the book and this particular episode.
Yeah, so Essie Tregowan as an Irish woman rather than a Cornish woman, that was something that was different.
Essie's tied to the leprechaun rather than the pixies or any other kind of spirit, so they really wanted to tie the Tregowan tale to Mad Sweeney. And the prayers that that are eponymous with this episode. Andy, what about you?
Yeah, well, we get more stuff about Mad Sweeney in general, which might explain why he reanimated Laura. Mad Sweeney wasn't a part of this, although the Essie Tregowan tale in the book was a major part of this book. It was one of these major coming to America tales. Mad Sweeney wasn't in it at all. It was the Pixies. So, and I think at this time in the book, spoilers, Mad Sweeney was not it was no longer a major part of the story. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Very different. Different layout of the story. Yeah. I mean, that's the last thing I feel here, except for talking about these performances. Emily Browning, what do you guys think?
Yeah, she's really, I think she is really proving a heavy hitter in this show. You know, outside of, you know, I've already expressed my sort of, I'm not going to say disappointment, but less than stellar performance that I think Ricky Whittle leaves me a little wanting. I feel like he wasn't quite ready to take on the main member of this series. I'll be honest with you, but I think that between Emily Browning and Ian McShane and Pablo Schreiber, I think Pablo Schreiber also, man, I mean, this is like huge for him, going from Porn Stash on Orange Is the New Black to this. I mean, this is a real groundbreaking role for Pablo Schreiber as well. It's really gonna like cement him in the consciousness of TV viewers. So big props to everyone on the show. Except for Ricky Whittle. And I'm sorry. Oh, wow. I'm sorry. Wow.
Giving him shade, even in an episode he's not in. Wow.
I know. It's like, I guess Andy didn't miss him at all. Tosin, what do you think about Ricky Whittle, Emily Browning, Pablo Schreiber in this situation?
Well, I mean, I think we know who the strongest ones are. He's part of the weakest link. What I'd actually want to mention quickly is the music in this episode. I really actually loved the choices they had.
Oh, yeah.
This felt like it was like, you know, the runaround Sue.
Yeah.
This felt like the type of thing that you see them do with like Westworld, right? Where like the music is just part and parcel of the episode and just really enriches it. And
yeah.
I feel like this is the first time first time I've felt that within, you know, the music of the other episodes. So
I feel like Browning as S.C. Chagowan, in the beginning of the episode, it was stronger than toward the end. You get wrapped up in the beginning about like the hair, the makeup, the bit of the you know, the wig, whatever. Like, you don't notice it's a wig, things like that. Later on, I think it does fall off a bit as you recognize the accent isn't quite as strong,
right,
as it could have been. But I think Browning is doing a pretty good job. I think Schreiber is doing a better job of all of the young actors. When we think about Whittle, Browning, and Schreiber, kind of like the young guns on this show. When it comes to Whittle, I still think that he kind of was given the least to work with to create a character out of the base. I mean, his character is present a lot in the book, but it doesn't have a lot of feeling. Now, Browning has taken a character that has, you know, relatively fewer lines in the books.
Yeah.
In the book. And she's taken it to a different level. But I also feel like a lot of her scenes are focused on who she is by herself, as opposed to reacting to things and the way that Shadow has to react to things. And it's those reaction shots that are the weak link in Whittle's performance. It's like, what is going on here? Or like, what? Like, he is incredulous, or his face skins up because he doesn't get what's going on. Those are the weak links in his performance, as opposed to when he's talking to Laura. When he talks to Laura, that feels real, you know? But almost all the other stuff, it doesn't feel real. And part of it's because it's not real. Now, if Patrick Stewart were in his prime and he was thrown into that situation, we'd completely believe it. And I think that's an interesting thing. So you need strong actors in speculative fiction. And well, I'm not going to say Ricky Whittle can't do it. I'm going to say that he, I can see where you're coming from with your criticism.
I also want to, Tosin, thanks for bringing up the thing about the music, because I definitely wanted to mention that. I thought it was an interesting, incongruous choice to have like 50s. The whole S.E. Chagowan tale, they sort of,
the anachronistic music, right?
The
music
they scored with like late 50s, early 60s doo-wop, right?
Yeah, that threw me off a lot too. Maybe that was a turnoff for me, because they did a lot of work to get some kind of like river dancey Celtic kind of action going on for much of those scenes. And then when she was being bad, like, you know, when she was like shoplifting effectively.
Yeah.
And they made it like 20th century American music. And I mean, I get it's an American Gods thing. I get that. But at the same time, that Irish action sounded pretty good to me. That Celtic music.
Well, it's different, different strokes for different folks, I guess, for sure. I thought it was interesting. What do we hope to see in the next episode? Next episode, I believe, is the very last episode of the season, right? So
season finale.
Season finale coming up.
Yep.
What do we hope to see in this? How do we hope that this thing wraps up? I honestly don't know where we're going anymore since we veered so radically from the book. Like, I have no idea where we're going to end up at the end of this season.
Somewhere in America. According to Ivis.
Thanks for that. Tosin, what about you? What do you think we're going to end up at the end of the season?
Maybe the gathering that they're driving. What's his name is driving to in the taxi?
Wednesday? Or that Salim is going to?
Salim is going to. Maybe we'll end up there.
That's right. I mean, Wednesday gets killed Vulcan, I guess. So whether he goes over there or not is a different story. I would like to see the interaction between Mr. Nancy and Mr. Wednesday, which was, you know, here's my friend, that kind of thing. Mr. Nancy had to do some sort of convincing to get people to join Wednesday's troop. That hasn't happened. And I thought that was pretty essential to story. So it's surprising that hasn't happened, but yeah, maybe we'll see Salim kind of hiking up a hill, and as we get to the crest, there's a whole bunch of like crazy looking superhero god people there.
Wow.
And that's the closing scene.
Feels a little premature, like, for the end of season one, right? Especially if they're going to stretch this out to 5 seasons.
Yeah, 5 is a lot of seasons. I feel like this, I mean, I'm all about less is more.
Yeah, so I feel like we could wrap this up in 3, really.
Yes.
As long as
you probably could have wrapped it up in 1 if you stuck to the book. But yeah, I think wrapping it up in 3 makes the most sense.
Right. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of The Dominant Paradigm. Join us next week when we talk about the next episode of American Gods, the very last episode of the season, titled Come to Jesus. So interesting, because Jesus.
That's what happens when you have a shitty ass day at work and your boss is like, we need to talk.
Would you step in my office for a moment? Yeah, that's your come to Jesus moment. Yeah, it's really interesting because Jesus does not appear at all in the novel. Although if you have the extended version of the novel, there's a sort of an extra bonus chapter where we do get to meet Jesus. So it's interesting that.
And not the Jesus that we thought not the Jesus that was available in the show so far, a different incarnation of
not
Jesus.
Not Mexican Jesus.
Right, exactly.
So this will be an interesting episode to see. So so that's it for this episode of Dominant Paradigm. Join us next week, and we'll talk about American Gods next week. Where can we find you guys when you're not here talking about American Gods?
You can check me out at DwayneD.com, DwayneD. You can also check me out at Twitter.com/DwayneD, where I talk about IoT, connected car, green tech, and things like that. Check me out on all the things that Andy's going to talk about at the end of the show when he talks about his stuff. Tosin, where can we find you?
Find me at Twitter.com/Toast4321. Other ramblings at ToastR2D2.tumblr.com. And you can find me at GeeksOfDoom.com. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com or just do a Google search for Andrew Cerasini or MrBabyMan, my social media handle, and you'll find everything that I'm linking throughout the week there, all my social media stuff. As far as what I'm doing with these guys here, you can find more work on the Geeks of Doom podcast network, where we do a weekly tech show called The Drill Down. And we also did a podcast for season 1 of Westworld called Violent Delights. And of course, you can find all of that at geeksofdoom.com or just search for those titles on iTunes and you'll find them there. Other than that, join us next week for the last episode this season of American Gods on The Dominant Paradigm. And we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, guys.